You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
It was the year of fire.
The year of destruction.
The year we took back what was ours.
It was the year of rebirth.
The year of great sadness.
The year of pain. And the year of joy.
It was a new age.
It was the end of history.
It was the year everything changed.
The year is 2261.
The place, Babylon 5. The podcast is the Epsilon 3.
Right here on the ESO Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And this is our 7th anniversary show. And we have got two very special guests sitting in with us for our 7th anniversary. Madeline Brumby and Shane Morton are back with us again. Yeah, we didn't chase them away. We got the one-two combination again, and we have picked a movie for you that this could be a fun one because I don't think we're all going to agree. Of course, I mean, people say Maddox and I disagree all the time. But no, this is going to be a movie that had quite an impact on folks in the early 70s. And it has different impacts on the different generations coming behind it. We're talking about The Exorcist, based on the classic novel written by
William Peter Blatty.
Thank you. Boy, I'll tell you what, it chokes me up to talk about this movie. This movie had quite an impact on me. So I want to a little background here for those of you that may not have been around when this movie came out. Blatty wrote the book. It did not do very well when it first came out. In fact, he was considering it almost a failure until he went on the Dick Cavett show, which at the time was one of the hottest nighttime talk shows that was on TV. And his appearance on that show generated so much interest that within a week, the novel shot up to the New York Times bestseller list. And then all of a sudden, it got all kinds of attention. I mean, movie studios had turned down his offer to write a screenplay and all that. And then all of a sudden, now everybody wanted the book. I found out about it. I had just started college a year before when the book came out. And, you know, I'm the monster kid on campus. Around a bunch of us from high school all went to the same college. And they're all wondering why I had not read this book and all that. This is your kind of thing and all that. So that's how I found out about it, because I missed the Cavett show. I read the book, was absolutely terrified. It is a very, very powerful book. By the way, parents, if you're listening to the podcast, we'll be discussing some very graphic things here and there in a couple of particular scenes in this movie. And I would say this movie is not for small children, like a couple of movies we've already talked about this season. So this is not a good one for the kids, I don't think. If they're in high school or whatever, I think they're going to be okay with it. But the little kids can get very, very scared on it. Anyway, the movie came out and was just an absolute smash. And if you figure out, it was shot on a $12 million budget. And it's so far, if you figure in inflation over the years and stuff, it has made more money for this studio than any other film they've ever made. So it was an unqualified success. And the only downside to it was that it generated an atrocious sequel. So, and we're not going to even talk about that on this show. So, so anyway, there's a little bit of a background. The third one.
No, Fabio Angel.
Yeah, I'm going to say none of the sequels to me measured up to the first one, to the one we're talking about on this show. And even the prequels, Dominion, it just didn't do anything for me either. But this one is very loyal to the book. It is a little sanitized. The book is far, far more gruesome and dark and graphic. But for 1973, folks, this film came out the day after Christmas, which I found so it was one of the big Christmas releases of the year and immediately generated controversy among the church crowd. In fact, I've got a story I'll tell a little later on about arguing with someone waiting in line to see this movie, who was telling me how I was going to burn and go to hell if I went in to watch the movie. It was an interesting time back in 1973. This country was going through some weird stuff. So anyway, wow. Shane and Madeline, I want to talk to you about a little bit, because we saw each other while I'm recording this. This was the day after one of the Silver Screen Spook shows, the Revenge of the Creature one.
Yeah.
And we nibbled on it a little bit. You know, I know you guys aren't really as into The Exorcist probably as I am. So tell me a little bit about y'all's experience with it.
I'm way into the Dick Smith aspect of it and all the great makeup,
yes,
special effects tricks.
Yes.
Like, I loved it. But possession movies and like Roman Catholic priests as heroes was something that never really worked for me. I usually have a problem overall with like religious horror movies, because I really don't buy into that stuff.
Yeah.
So when a movie, for me, Evil Dead does possession right, because there's nothing's going to help you with that. You know,
yes,
like if one of those demons gets you, the only way to beat it is total bodily dismemberment, you know? But
something
never worked for me is I had a problem as a child, like growing up with the church. I never, I was not a fan of it, and we had some issues with my family with the church. So, I've always had a problem with the church. So, seeing the church as a heroic thing didn't work for me even as a kid. But you know, the first time I saw it, I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And it was freaky, you know, it scared
it me. Is. It's a movie that messes with your head. Yeah.
Yeah. The sound
really
does
mess
really
with your
gets
head.
You all the
oh, God,
voices,
yeah,
and stuff. It really got me. But, Madeline's got probably the most badass story.
Really.
I didn't know this until this morning. She told me this and I was like, wow, I've got new respect for you, Madeline.
Well,
you've heard it here first, folks.
Shane, I was like, Shane, we've got to do this podcast. And I don't have enough time to rewatch the movie. I haven't watched it probably since I was a teenager the first time.
Oh, wow.
And, so I figured out that the movie was playing. I'm pretty sure it was playing on HBO, and we had this weird leftover account from the previous owners of the house that for somehow we got HBO for free for years.
All right.
One day it just vanished. You know, it was a sad day. But
they figured it out. Yeah.
I don't know. It just somebody turned off.
Tell the story about the exorcists.
Okay. Anyway.
How did you see that?
Well, I was like, okay, I've heard about this movie. It's supposed to be the scariest movie ever. And I was like, okay, I'm going to watch this in the basement by myself. So I turned it on and I was waiting and waiting to just be terrified. And then I just started laughing because it just wasn't scary to me. So a lot of what was supposed to be terrifying, like slaps and over the top behavior, barfing, all of it came across to me as comedic and not scary. And this also comes
from, it's just crazy.
It, for me, this type of horror doesn't resonate with me that in that way. Mm-hmm, so I'm not sort of your ideal candidate for watching this type of
religious horror.
Yeah. So yeah, it just isn't for me. But that doesn't mean I don't appreciate what the film is and what it represented at the time. It's technically a very impressive film, as the actors that perform it, their performances are astounding. The sound design, the difficulty for how hard the shoot was for a lot of these actors, and the conditions of the set and work conditions.
The performance of the team, of the little girl, like Linda Blair, is
just amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing performance. So
there's a lot to love technically about it. Sure.
And we're going to spend probably a lot of time talking on that.
It's great.
Yeah. Well, it's I was going to say, it's interesting, Madeline.
Her experience is very different from most.
Yeah. Now your experience is very similar to the second time I saw this movie. This movie was still playing Spring Break when I came home. To where my mom and dad were living. They were living in Georgia at the time, and my mom said, "Have you seen that movie, The Exorcist?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "Well, you know, your dad doesn't want to see it, but I want to see it." And I said, "Well, I'll go take you to see it again." I said, "It was an amazing movie." And so we went and saw it in Rome, Georgia, of all places, very, very conservative little town in Northwest Georgia. This is where I got into an argument with someone standing in line. We're waiting in line to get in, and some this religious group is out there protesting it, and they get into, you know, they're telling everybody they're going to go burn in hell and stuff if they see the movie. And my mom said, just settle down. She knew I was going to argue with the people. She said, "No, you don't want to do that." You know, and I said, "Hey, have you seen this movie?" There's a, "No, we haven't seen this movie." "Then how the hell can you tell us anything about seeing this movie or not? Because I've seen it and I'm not burning it." You know, so she's like, "Oh my God." Yeah. Anyway, we get into the movie. So, you know, mom has heard me sort of talk about how it messed with my mind and stuff. And I saw it in a movie theater, then had to drive back to my dorm in the dark. And it just messed with me, the subliminal images and stuff. And it just really screwed with me. My mom gets in the theater, and every scene, she's laughing her ass off. Every funniest damn movie she'd ever. And people around her are like, "Who is this lady?" You know? And she walked out of the theater with this big smile on her face. And these people are just like horror struck that she had that reaction. And I'm sort of like, "Can I just crawl under the seat? I can't believe she's reacting this way." While everyone's screaming, she's just, and she gets home. My dad said, "How's the movie?" She says, "Oh, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen." You know, she's kind of bawling and stuff. So that was not an unusual reaction. Now, I will say, I'd not seen this movie in about 30 years when I watched it the other day. Day before yesterday is when I watched the movie. Uh-huh. And I had, I had never seen it during the day. So I was watching it in the middle of the afternoon, and a lot of the effects as far as frightening effects didn't hit home at all. So I think seeing it in the dark or at night or whatever probably has a different impact on people as well. But I sort of marveled at the fact, just like, yeah, this scenes I was anticipating would probably just get me a rise a little bit. It didn't scare me at all the other day. Mm-hmm. So, this is not a movie I've seen many, many times. I probably saw it two or three times when it first, I did see the one of the HBO showings, and that was about it for many, many years. So the religion aspect of it, I don't know. I never really thought in that term. I grew up in a Catholic town, so I was sort of used to that sort of thing, as far as, you know, priests and all that stuff. But I was more, now as an adult, more blown away by the technical aspects of it. I just amazed, like,
technically, super impressive.
Well, as a horror fan and a geek, as a kid, because like you say, Monster Kid, I was a Monster Kid, and I will never forget getting that issue, Famous Monster, with the blue cover, with the profile of this Dick Smith makeup, and the tongue's coming out, and it's like really gross, and I'm like, I want to see The Exorcist, and my whole family was like, you are not going to see The Exorcist, because I must have been old, or 6 years old.
Yeah.
They were like, no, you're not going to see this movie. And I'm like, Fari says it's great. Like, he's saying it's like the greatest new horror movie ever. And seeing, there were stories on the news, people fainting from fear and throwing up in the theater. And there was ambulance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you famous monster, the William Cast movies with the gimmicks. And this, people were really falling out. I was just like,
well, there's a classic story about Ellen Burstyn, who when she went, she went and saw the film. She was shooting another movie, and they were showing The Exorcist in the town that they were shooting the movie in. So she thought, I'm just going to go see it, because she'd seen it at the premiere, but she hadn't seen it since then. And during that showing, a woman got out of her seat and started wobbling up the aisle, and Ellen is like, oh, she's going to faint, you know, and this could be bad. Yeah. I mean, you know, just she's going to fall. So she goes and helps the lady. And when she gets to the lady, the lady faints. And then she gets thinking, oh my God, if she comes to and sees I'm over her. So she grabs someone, she gets another lady sitting nearby, says, please help me. She says, I can't let this woman see me when she comes, because they were calling her.
That's hilarious. So,
and that was the effect it was having on some people. I wasn't, and none of the two showings in theaters that I went and saw it, I didn't, nobody fainted or whatever, but there was some, you know, the reaction to
it
the
was mass
soup,
hysteria,
vomit and stuff. Yeah, it was. It was
total,
that was a
hysteria.
Little difficult. And of course,
go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say, and of course, the look on Jason Miller's face when he gets hit with the pea soup.
Oh yeah,
was legitimate, because it was a trick that went awry. It was just supposed to be some of it hits him in the cheek, and the tube broke loose and hit him flat out in the face. And so that is all real reaction there. He was really pissed. and then freaking said, yeah, we'll just keep that. We don't have to retake that.
Yeah, we're not going to do that again. But yeah, I remember the mass hysteria, just being a kid and seeing the news and reading about it, because I was like obsessed with it. And I have a feeling that it had something to do with the big born again movement that happened.
No, that's exactly right. No, that when I said that there was a lot going on in this country back then, from about 1970 to about 1975, there was this big spiritual movement going on in this country. And this was the rise.
I thought it was after 75.
Well, that's when the televangelists started picking up the ball and running with it. Then they really were coming in. But I mean, we had Billy Graham, but he was really the only big evangelist type guy. Then all of a sudden they just started coming out of the woodwork. And it all was, you know, like 72 was a banner year for that.
Really? Because I always think of it as being like more of the late 70s when it really hit my family.
That's when PTL and
the born again movement. I mean,
Swagger
even
and stuff.
Dylan.
Yeah, that was mid to late 70s. Really started catching fire, and all of the religion for profit stuff, as I call it, because
well, even
it didn't
Bob
have anything
Dylan
to do with spirituality.
Yeah, Bob Dylan renounced his Jewish heritage, became a Christian. Like so many people were doing it. It was like the whole Jesus freak movement. And I always thought
that had its roots right around 1970, and then really caught fire about the mid 70s.
Yeah.
So that had a lot to do with, I think this film, if it had been released any other time, probably would have been a whole different experience for folks.
Yeah. Might not have caught on.
If it had come out later, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But it was a game changer at the time.
Yeah, it sure was. And then you had the Italian ripoffs that were coming out every month. You know,
well, yeah, that you know, Beyond the Door came out the next year, and that was just that was a but it did make the Exorcist did make me go out and get the Dick Smith book because I was you know, when I saw his it was like, yes, I have got to have this book. Because I was still doing stage magic at the time. I did that as a kid for many years. So, but his makeup stuff was just legendary.
It is. So, like, you know, I'm looking at this old age makeup on Max von Sydow right now. He's in the.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's in the room doing the thing. And he didn't work. He didn't get work for a while after this because everybody thought he was an old man. You know, like,
yeah, I did. I had, you know, I really didn't know a lot of work. I had not seen a lot of films that he'd been in. So I kept thinking, oh yeah, I guess he is an old guy. I had no, you know, a lot of people didn't realize he was only like 44 years old, I think, when he did the movie. What an incredible makeup job.
Yeah. His makeup.
And the makeup they did for, and Linda Blair's makeup is legendary. I just,
I've got a pull of it downstairs. Like somebody got me a copy of the master plate that Dick Smith used to pull the appliances for and stuff.
Wow.
But it's beautiful work, and I love all the as a kid I really loved all the subliminal stuff, you know, because especially the stuff they do with Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera, right? Because they, you know, the claim is that the first jump scare in movie history is the unmasking of the phantom, right? That's the first it's the first known jump scare in film, right?
Yeah.
And he, of course, Dick Smith, who's just the master of all this, knows that. So what do they use to embody the character of Pazuzu, the demon? It's the Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera makeup, and you see it hiding in refrigerator doors, and it's popping up in the wall. Really neat how they did all that stuff.
Well, you know, and that was the fun part about watching it the other day, because the only other time I had seen this movie not in the theater had either been on the HBO showing, which, you know, again was on a small, like a 19-inch TV set. It was a color set, so, but I mean, and then I had a VHS copy of it, and I probably watched it a couple of times on VHS. Now I'm watching it on 4K, and I started seeing all that stuff again. I had not seen that since I'd seen the original showing in the theater, and I was oh my God, there he is. There's the little superimposed image here and there, and because that was the stuff that really messed with me when I first saw this. I couldn't get those images; they would pop into my head, like these horrible flashbacks, you know. Or, you know, I don't know if I really had a nightmare, so to speak, for the few nights after that, but I just couldn't get those images out of my head, and they were
They shot it like a magic trick too, like how a flash thing happens,
right?
And it just burns your retina, right? So, and it's if you look at that makeup, and it's a stage makeup. He had just done a stage makeup on somebody of the fan, like you can see the lines of the brush strokes and everything.
Yeah, they were the samples that they didn't use for the final makeup. It was all of it. They used the test shots
that he was
doing to try to come up with Linda Blair's makeup. Now it was interesting in the television broadcast. I did see one of the television broadcasts of it. They took all that stuff out. They didn't have the super because there was a big controversy over somebody had sued the studio for damages or something because of what the superimposed images did to them mentally or something.
The studio just settled
out of court, but the networks were very, very, even HBO was a little hesitant about broadcasting this movie.
Wow.
Because of stuff like that. So, I mean, it really messed with people in this country for a long, long time.
Yeah, and this stuff with the we're watching the refrigerated set.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that, so, I didn't know that for you.
Playing
years.
In the background. Yeah, we just have it playing in the background. While
I didn't know that for you. They had like four air conditioners to chill the room down. Linda Blair said it was like one of the worst experiences she'd ever had. Cause I mean, through that, you know, the others were at least bundled up a little bit, but she was just in a little nightgown basically. And, you know, and most of her scenes were
covered in pea soup and just has like one little blanket.
That's and it. So at the So that I did not know for the longest time until I started reading film books on this movie that they actually cooled the room down to about 35 degrees to get the breadth of it. It's like amazing some of the stuff they did. There was a lot of things. Ellen Burstyn actually got seriously injured in the scene where she is hit by Reagan and throws it. She broke her coccyx and actually did some permanent spine damage. She's had problems with her back ever since then. She said it was one of the hardest shoots she'd ever been involved with.
I think everybody who worked on the shoots, that's their major remark about it, is that it was so difficult.
Well, Friedkin is kind of legendary for being a, what would you call it, an irresponsible director with his cast.
Well, he nearly lost his life from Jason Miller. He wanted to get there was supposed to be a scene where Jason Miller reacts very quickly, you know, stunned or whatever. And he shot off a gun next to his head to get started. And Miller didn't know that was coming. And Miller just about took him out. And he said, I'm an actor. I don't need that to act startled, for God's sake. But they finally, so he and Miller were sort of on very testy ground during the 222 days they shot this thing. It was supposed to be an 85 day shoot and it went a little overboard in some of the stuff they were doing. Yeah. Have you guys ever been to Georgetown? Have you seen where they shot this?
Well, I was going to tell you about that. So my first wife lived there. She would say that they would smoke weed on the Exorcist steps after school.
It's a legendary place
where all the punk rockers, punk rockers would hang out. And every time we'd go up there for Christmas or whatever to visit her family, we'd go check out the Exorcist steps. And, you know, that whole area over there is kind of legendary still.
I got to admit, because I had relatives that lived in, I had a relative in Silver Springs and the one actually in Washington, D.C., and we'd go up occasionally to visit them. And I had to go down to the Georgetown to check out the steps. And first time, it sort of creeped me out a little bit. Although there's a big field next to the steps that you know, the movie makes you think that the house or whatever is right next to the steps.
Is right there.
It would have been impossible for anybody to fly out a window and go down those steps. it still sort of creeped me out a little bit. It's like, oh God. Yeah. So that.
But that's funny. But yeah, this thing, it was just like all over the place everywhere. I remember, you know, my parents would let us stay up and watch Saturday Night Live because we loved Mr. Bill. Yeah. And I remember the thing with Richard Pryor. The bed is on my foot. You know, your mother wears cowboy boots. You know, that whole thing. And it was just, it was Exorcist fever. I guess it was 3 years before Jaws would come out, and I was finally allowed to go see one of these movies with red
Jaws would come out 2 years later. That was the big summer release of 75, if I'm not mistaken.
And I was I was living on Simon's Island at the time, so everybody was terrified of sharks. It was so great. But you know, once again, there you're seeing the mass hysteria of what
that's true.
The media blitz from this movie is done to the whole zeitgeist and just watching society just go crazy over this whether it's the Exorcist movie or the big shark movie, it was just wild as a kid to watch.
And movies just didn't, movies didn't really do that, you know, around this time period. I mean, I loved the 70s film wise because it was such a treasure trove of independent films. And I'm going back now and looking at some of those films, you know, because he had the multiplex theaters. You might have 8 different movies in one multiplex. And, you know, so you had a lot of low budget stuff and hard edge indie stuff. And I mean, that's where I really, really, I mean, I was in a movie theater 2 or 3 times a week in high school because of all the great films that, you know, all some of these underappreciated films that, you know, they weren't all Easy Rider. I mean, there were just some that were just real gems that, that you only could see them because they'd only be in the theaters for maybe 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So you didn't see this big excitement for films, except for maybe like The Godfather. I mean, that one sort of took over the country for quite a while when it came out a few years before this, but it just never happened. I've never seen anything like this. The place just went nuts over this movie. Of course, now it's been spoofed so many times, I think that probably takes a lot of the edge off of it for folks that haven't seen it.
Yeah.
And watching it now, they've probably seen the spoofs like Repossessed and stuff. That
It would be impossible to go into this totally, with a clean slate. You know, it's too much part of the fabric of...
You just know about it.
Yeah.
I don't think that you can... see it the way that you saw it, where it was the first.
Oh no, I don't think so.
The purity of it.
Yeah.
The only movie I can think of that came close to rivaling that years later was a very fun movie. Well, I shouldn't say fun. It was a dark film called The Believers, which was a religious type. Movie. It's centered on Santeria. So it had a little bit of a Catholic influence there as well. But that one just caught me totally off guard because when I went to it not really knowing what I was going to go see. And it was like, wow. I mean, it was so out of
people's faces.
Yeah, yeah. It just, and then when I found out that, wait a minute, there really is a Santeria. I mean, I didn't know anything about this stuff. Really was a religion that was based on voodoo and Catholicism and stuff. And it was like, wow. But that was the first time that, you know, because I'm like you, Shane, I wasn't really into the heavyweight religious, you know, which they became a dime a dozen after The Exorcist. And it was just like, they didn't do much for me either. It was just like, okay, we got it. It's already been done.
Yeah.
But I did go see Beyond the Door Beyond the Door, whatever it was.
Beyond the Door.
Whatever it was, the one, that awful one with, I can't think of her name, not the gal's name. It was just atrocious. I almost walked out of the theater. It was so bad. And I love Italian horror films, but that was just a waste of time. It was so awful.
Yeah, Beyond the Door. Some of those Italian possession movies are awesome. Like, I love the Fulci stuff. Like, you know,
Fulci is one of my favorites. Yep.
All that. Yeah, I love it when he does it. But yeah, you couldn't get away from Exorcist movies for a while after this. It's kind of like what Conan the Barbarian did for Sword and Sandal reinvention.
Right.
There was a new sword and sorcery movie every 2 months, and it was like usually pretty unwatchable. You're getting stuff like Ator the Fighting Eagle, and it was pretty bad. And we were seeing all of that stuff, and we were like so blown away by Conan, and we were into that stuff. So I sat through many of those.
It was sort of compared to the Steve Reeves stuff that I grew up with. It was like, wow, this is great. They did it so well. Well, I want to say to the folks out there, again, this is not for small kids, but to this to date, I can't think of anybody who is currently burning in hell for watching this film. I don't think it produced any mass murderers.
Not to your knowledge.
Not to my knowledge anyway, so I think we came out of it pretty clean.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's funny that they would come at this movie like that, because this movie is actually a very pro-Christian film. You know, it's like,
it is well,
you know, God is the good guy, and
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it's uh So it did wonders for the church, you know, like I was saying earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like it.
Yeah.
Am I remembering this incorrectly? But wasn't a lot of it funded by the church?
Well, it's all like, I'm sure the Roman Catholic Church had to put some money into this thing, right? Like,
yeah.
They definitely backed it when it came out, and they were like, "Oh, go see this movie." It's just like the Passion of the Christ did that too, that gore.
You know, there was a similar fervor with that. Well, you're right. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, but I remember going to see that movie, and I got very, very upset because I didn't know that I was working for a newspaper at the time, and they got us free tickets to go see the Passion, and I didn't realize that it was being sponsored by some big church in the area.
Yeah. Yeah, and as soon as
the movie ended, they turned it off before the credits rolled. Now, I'm an old purist. I like to see the credits.
Yeah, we do too.
That's part of the experience. And, you know, and so they turn that off, and then they start preaching. So as I'm leaving the theater, quizzing everybody about, what did you think? What did you think? And I said, you screwed the whole damn movie up. I said, you know, I wanted to see the damn movie, not hear you guys preaching. I don't need you guys to tell me what I just saw. And then, you just blew the whole, you know, they just were horror struck. And I wrote an editorial about it for the newspaper, which just, oh my God.
I
was just like Satan incarnate for a couple of weeks after that editorial. Because I was pissed.
Sure.
I was like, no, man, you don't have the right to do that.
Well, I was pissed that they were bringing children to see that movie, because I have seen 1,000 horror movies, and I have never seen a horror movie as reprehensible and as pornographic and its gory display than The Passion of Christ. It's by far the most revolting movie I've ever seen. I saw it, there were people like crying. They were brought children to it, and I was just like, what is happening here? This is not right.
Yeah, how many kids? Yeah, so, many kids traumatized as were that whose parents brought them to Jurassic Park, because that was No,
Jurassic
unbelievable.
Park's okay, Passion of Christ.
Oh man, I love Jurassic Park.
No, I'm just going to say, I just remember being in the theater with some real little kids who thought, I think they were going to go see Barney or something. That were just oh my god, they were terrified, so terrified. But the reactions to this film.
Some movies are not for kids.
Yeah. And folks, this is not one of them. I mean, I still would not let a little kid watch this movie. I think there's just too much that can mess with their head. And there's going to be a lot of stuff that goes over their head. But because there's some really gruesome graphic stuff. And folks, I'd have to say, this is going to be a tough call, but I think this may be a film that has got some of the most graphic, controversial scenes in it of any movie we've ever done on Monster Attack. And the only reason I'm hesitant is because I just done a show on The Deadly Spawn. So it's like that one sort of was very, very, I love that film too. But I was, that was a pretty gruesome one compared to some of the ones we've talked about in the past. So,
we've hit you with two of them. The little girl. The girl on the cross.
Girl on the cross, but also the...
That's a rough scene,
Really, the medical treatment that she receives as well, which I'm not really sure had been done in films before with such detail of cerebral treatment. And it's things that that really bother you.
The sound design in those scenes is the thing that really got to me when I first saw this movie. The boom, 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 you know, and just how terrifying. I've been through all those kind of things now with my heart situation and stuff, but back then I didn't know anything about how those CT scans were done and all that stuff, and how frightening that had to be for people. I mean, it was just, God, it was horrible. But they brought that out very, I think that was almost as terrifying as her being possessed, as far as, what she had to go through. The medical treatment was almost as bad as what she was, going through. Yeah. So I think it was a point, interesting point that he made there. I really appreciated that. as to a couple of some of the other, I guess the blasphemous, the two big blasphemous scenes that a lot of people had problems with, I would say to them, don't read the book, because it's even worse than the book.
Oh, yeah.
What Blatty wrote. I mean, he allowed Friedkin and the producers to sanitize it down a little bit, because they said, no, we cannot do this quite like you had it in the book. So we'll do the best we can. But, and still, it was pretty, that got more of the response from people than anything, I think, in the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
The statue and the little girl with the cross. That, that
you gotta wonder
shook
when
a lot of people.
Movie will get canceled for that.
Well, it was interesting. There was someone out there who's an expert on this could correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it was the British Censorship Board. People were shocked that they left those two scenes in and didn't request them be taken out. And they said, we did that because this film was so brilliantly made and has such a powerful story, we felt it needed to be in there. And everyone's like, whoa, who is this? You know, these guys cut usually cut all kinds of things that are violent. Like that, but they left it in. They left it in. Yeah. So it was like, because the artistry of this film, there's no denying that it's a beautifully made film.
The Library of Congress thought so too. So
yeah.
And
almost everybody that appeared in this film could have won an Academy Award. I mean, a lot of them were nominated.
And the film was nominated, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the film was nominated for Best Picture. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't make a category for special effects makeup then. You know, that it.
I agree. It should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It really should have been. Because there's so many groundbreaking things being done with the bladder effects and all that stuff.
Right.
That you would go on to.
Really I mean, he pulled out all the stops on this thing. Really, he really did.
Yeah.
And a special shout out to Mercedes McCambridge, because I mean, she didn't even get a credit in the original release. She had to sue the studio to get a credit put in there that, you know, because for almost close to a year, it wasn't quite a year that people didn't realize Linda Blair did not say those horrible things she was saying, but that was Mercedes McCambridge dubbed over. And it a lot of people thought that if that had not come out, the Linda Blair probably would have won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. But they said that knowledge, when it came out, hurt her a little bit in the voting on one. So they thought that might have been why she lost the award that year or whatever. But I mean, the things that Mercedes McCambridge had to do she was a recovering alcoholic. But she said in order to get the tone of the tenor of quality of voice, she started smoking again. She had given up smoking for a while, and then said, if I drink whiskey, I can make it. It'll do what I need it to do to give me that quality of voice. But she had somebody watch her to make sure she didn't go overboard, because she didn't want to
totally
go back
off the wagon.
Yeah, she didn't go totally off the. I mean, it was just like, and some of the other stuff she did to get that quality. It's like, yeah, I didn't realize she went through all of that just to, but it's a sound like there's like no other. I mean, it's just incredible how that
incredible.
Take that away from the movie and you lose a lot of the power that it had.
So one of the first times that I took Madeline to stay at Queens in New York, we did a spook show on Coney Island. I took her to the Museum of the Moving Image, and they've got a lot of Dick Smith stuff there, including the spinny head puppet of Linda Blair.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So she got to see that.
Which is an incredible museum. If
it is.
Anyone listening
awesome museum.
Has not attended
yes.
it.
No,
is
it is.
One of those
it should be on your bucket list.
Yeah. We, at the time, they were doing a Men in Black exhibit too.
Oh, and it was
cool.
Rick Baker stuff in there. Like,
and
so wonderful.
Some of these aliens didn't get many close ups, but seeing the prosthetics and then the headwear, the gear, the the weaponry that they had created was so cool.
But the great part was that Men in Black 3 had that whole 50s thing. So it was like Rick Baker's version of Invasion Saucer Men. Rick Baker's Creature from the Black Lagoon, if he was a goldfish. Rick Baker's doing, the Metal and a Mutant. There was a hideous sun demon that he had done that got no coverage in the movie. It was just like all this beautiful stuff. So, and there's always something great like that. But anytime you go to the Museum of the Moving Image, they've got like one of the biggest Dick Smith collections. And I'm pretty sure that the Exorcist spinny head puppet is there all the time.
And it's interesting. It wasn't William Friedkin screwed that up. Well, in a sense, he sort of screwed up. The head wasn't supposed to spin all the way around. He thought it was, but Friedkin said, no, that's not the way I wrote it. He misinterpreted what the book had said. That was, I don't have my copy of the book anymore. But it described, that the head almost turned all the way around it had that look to it. But, Friedkin thought, oh, it's turning head. Yeah, let's do that. And when Friedkin saw the rushes from that day, he was like, wait a minute, what is that? But they didn't want to reshoot it, so they left it in there.
It became an iconic thing,
That's a great effect. I remember watching the movie wondering why her head had to spin around, but I guess I think a lot of people were like, whoa, what is that? It's like an
habit. But when I first met Linda Blair, I wanted her to sign an autograph to me that said, "You make me want to puke." And she's a sweet lady. She wouldn't do that, but she wrote, "You make my head spin." I was like, oh, well,
that's good.
Yeah.
She couldn't be.
I haven't had a chance to meet her yet. I was at a convention she was at, but I couldn't get there in time to see her. But she's one I've always wanted to meet. She's a little younger than me, just a couple of years younger than me. But that's one that's on my bucket list. It's like I've got to meet her someday. She'd be an interesting person to talk to.
Yeah, she does a lot of work with animals and stuff.
Oh, huge! Yeah, no, that is her thing. In fact, she got so typecast from The Exorcist that she lost out on a lot. Like she was considered for the Black Lagoon, or not Black Lagoon, Blue Lagoon, and some other. In her teen years, and she always attributed to the fact that nobody's going to hire, the evil little girl. And so that's why she sort of embraced it. She appears in the spoof of The Exorcist, Repossessed. She had a good sense, and then she just sort of embraced all of the drive-in stuff and low budget stuff that she's done over the years, and had a blast doing it. And all that stuff. Because she had the two made for TV films that were highly acclaimed, and especially Born Innocent, which was a gutsy film to make. And I forgot the name of the other one right now. Sarah, it was about alcoholism or whatever. But I've always had a lot of respect for the way she sort of countered and moved with how Hollywood sort of turned its back on her. And because I think she would have won several awards down the road if they'd not cubbyholed her into Reagan McNeil, so to speak.
An iconic role like that, your friend.
Jason Miller's a guy that I became a big fan of his, even though he didn't do a lot. And that, this was like one of his first big role. I think this was his first big role. I'm trying to think of some of the people. Jack Nicholson originally was being considered for that, but Friedkin said, "I don't think that's going to work. I can't see Jack Nicholson as a."
And they had a lot of A-listers considered for a lot of the roles. Who was it who lived in Rome at the time? Was like, "Oh yeah, I'll do it if you shoot in Rome." It was somebody super famous.
Oh yeah. And there was one that actually got cast, and now the name just gets away from me now, that they ended up paying him. But when Friedkin had seen Jason Miller, who's a playwright, and had just published That Championship Season. In fact, he won the Pulitzer for that play while he was shooting The Exorcist. But that's, Friedkin had seen the play and seen him in that and said, that's the guy I want. That's he's a priest. I can see him as a priest who's struggling with his faith or whatever like that. And I think he played it beautifully. Absolutely.
Certainly.
Beautifully.
Says Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, Audrey Hepburn said she would
Audrey
take the
Hepburn
role.
Audrey Hepburn was considered for Chris. That was it. You're right. For Chris McNeil. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then even, Linda Blair has this iconic performance, but even Jamie Lee Curtis, her mom wouldn't let her audition for the role.
That's, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. I that blew me away that, you know, that,
yeah.
In fact, Linda Blair almost didn't her agency wasn't even going to send her out on the read. Her mother said, no, you're going to go read for this. And she just took her to the audition, because the agency wasn't even going to send her to the audition. It was like, you know, go figure. So some of these classic Hollywood stories.
Wow, that's interesting.
But she was, I think they were even considering Jodie Foster. I'm trying to think some of the names that
Denise
came up
Nickerson
for consideration.
From,
Denise Nickerson, yeah, from Dark Shadows.
Willy Wonka.
Which,
Violet Beauregard.
Yeah. I know, yeah. From Willy
You're
Wonka.
You're turning violent, Violet.
You're turning violent.
I don't think that would work. I don't know. I couldn't see that one. I mean, I love Dark
Shadows. I don't know.
Shadows,
sometimes.
I don't know. You never know.
Never know.
It just seemed like Linda, I can't visualize anyone other than Linda Blair playing this role.
Yeah, for
some reason, just some great stuff. The casting just worked so beautifully in this thing, and the music. I do want to mention that because Lalo Schifrin, I always mess up his name. Lalo Schifrin had been hired to do the soundtrack, and Friedkin hated it so much when he heard it. The story. I don't know if there's any truth to the story, but the story was that he ripped the tapes off the machine and threw them into the trash in front of Schifrin and his family.
Oh, man.
When they were there saying, here's the music I did for your movie. And a few days later, apparently, that's when Friedkin heard, was in a music library, and he heard Tubular Bells and went, that's the one I want. I got to admit that the music in The Exorcist jumped right out at me.
Yeah.
As far as Tubular Bells was unlike anything I'd ever heard in a movie or just anything I'd ever heard. And I wore that record out. I had it on vinyl. I mean, I literally wore that thing out. It's
a
brilliant score. Yeah, it's fun stuff. Well, you folks will have a chance to hear it when the show ends here. Because it was so unique back then. I mean, it was just that kind of electronic music just hadn't really caught on yet.
But after The Exorcist, man, was it on. You started.
Yeah, it was, and then everybody jumped the bandwagon. That's right. That's right. So this one was a game changer in many, many regards, good as well as bad. How it ended up spawning that horrible sequel, I'll never know. even Linda Blair was embarrassed by having to show up in that one. So and I think it might have killed Richard Burton. I'm not sure.
That was the thing that pushed him over the edge.
I think that was it. Yeah, I think that was it. So, any final thoughts, folks? Yeah, this movie was more of an event than it was anything, but quite a unique film in its own right.
Yeah.
I'll still like always have some fond feelings for it, just because of the impact it had on me. Because, you know, being a hardcore monster kid, it's like, okay, you know, I would walk into every horror film and say, go ahead, scare me, I dare you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they did. It was like, whoa, I'm impressed. You know?
Yeah.
They did, okay. But, you know, so it's always going to have that respect from me. But, yeah, it's been interesting to see how it's been received over the years.
Yeah, I think it'll definitely live on forever,
for sure. I think it will.
Oh yeah, no, I think there's enough elements in this film to study. You can for future filmmakers and stuff. Yeah, there's a lot in here to to technically, that's just it's definitely one of the more masterful type films ever made. And Friedkin really never did equal this down the road. I mean, he had some films that I liked his stuff, but nothing that ever came close to what this one did critically or financially. So, interesting film, folks. The Exorcist. Don't take the little kids. Don't let them watch it. But, yeah. I would recommend watching it at night if you haven't seen it on a widescreen. You know, you've got a big flat screen, you know, in full 4K glory. So you
alone
can see
all of the tricks.
In the basement. Don't watch it with me. Right.
All the tricks are back in there. All the subliminal stuff is in there and all that. You know, just make it pitch black. And have at it.
Yeah. Hopefully your experience will be more like yours, Jim, and not like Madeline.
Or my mom's. Yeah, but I will still never get over the fact that my mom thought this was one of the best comedies made in 1973. You guys got when's the next spook show coming up? You're gonna be doing a movie that we just talked about.
August 5th.
I should have held off and I for some reason I had a brain fart. And At the Earth's Core, which was such a fun movie. I'm looking forward to seeing that on a big screen again.
Yeah, so At the Earth's Core, August 5th, we will have our matinee at 1:30 and our late show at 10 p.m.
Excellent.
It'll be fantastic.
Yeah, we have done 3 black and white movies in a row, so we were like, let's hit them with something so colorful.
Yeah.
So psychedelic, because they just really... That movie is so pumped full of weird color.
Oh, it's so fun. It is so much fun. Yeah. Yeah,
it's got everything. You know, it's got Carolyn Monroe and Peter Cushing. You know,
that's enough for me.
Fights. Yeah. It's the best.
No, just Carolyn Monroe is fine for me. She can hold the whole film together. You know?
She could. She could.
And I think they actually let her talk in this one too, which is nice.
Yeah. Her voice.
I believe that is her voice, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. A fun movie. And was Amicus's last film. I think it was the last one that they made before they called it quits. So go check it out, folks. It's you know, and leave your science book at home. Because
it's Edgar Rice Burroughs. Who cares about science?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, don't worry about the science on this one. Just go have a lot of fun. All right, guys. Well, as I was telling you before the show, The Revenge of the Creature was a magnificent show. And I love the show before the show was just so much fun. I mean, I have a lot of fun with all your shows, but that one really just got me going. It was just like, God, that was when the ghost fish haunted us through the audience. That was like, that was so cool.
Those ghost fish were folks, so fun.
You're in the Atlanta area. You got to go see the Silver Screen Spook Show. You got to make sure put that on your calendar for August. All right, guys. Yeah. Hey, thanks for
thanks
us
so much. Happy anniversary. That's amazing.
Yeah, 7 years. That's 7 years. Big deal.
We almost didn't make this one for a while. I'll tell you, I didn't know if we were going to get through this season or not. The way things were going, but our fans kept us in the ball game, and so we are so glad to have made it through this. Great. And who knows? Maybe another 7 to go. We'll have to see.
Yeah,
anyway, folks, for the monster kids out there and for those of you that should be monster kids, hey, thank you for 7 phenomenal years and many more to come. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Monday.
Ask yourself, is the Flopcast the right podcast for you?
Do you have trouble picking a favorite Weird Al song, Karate Kid sequel, or Justice League Detroit member? Are you obsessed with Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch, Vicky the Captain's daughter from the Love Boat,
or Vicky the robot from Small Wonder?
Do you think Cyndi Lauper's We Are the World solo is the most important event in history?
You have half an hour a week for something completely stupid.
Then the Flopcast might be the right podcast for you.
We're on the ESO Network
and at flopcast.net.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.